Hello, on this week's program, David Patrick Stearns listens in on a recording by Piffero, the wind band, and the vocal group The Crossing of Kyle Smith's Vespers. Susan Lewis explores a recreated 16th century Lenape village at Bucks County's Churchville Nature Centre, which is hosting its annual powwow this weekend. We listen back to a roundtable discussion on the changing face of arts education in Philadelphia's public schools, and Jason Pfeiffer has a preview of Shakespeare in Clark Park. This year, the West Philadelphia Park will feature the Bard's romantic comedy, As You Like It. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Composer Kyle Smith has been part of the Philadelphia music community for decades, but such a quiet, solid part of it that some of those who have come to be deeply involved with his music didn't even know how to spell his first name last year at this time. It's K-I rather than K-Y-L-E. The composer has enjoyed what many consider to be a breakthrough creative experience with his evening-length choral work, Vespers, which was premiered in January and recorded this week for MMC Records by the early music group Piffero, which commissioned it, and the virtuoso choir, The Crossing. Now the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns reports from the recording sessions held in the picturesque St. Peter's Church in the Great Valley in Malvern.
The instruments are from the German Renaissance, the voices are from 21st century America, and the music is from, well, we'll get into that a little bit later. But for the moment, choir master Donald Nally is warming up his singers for their very first take. Though this is Kyle Smith's first major recording, the 51-year-old composer has been part of Philadelphia's new music community for decades and has written something in the neighborhood of 100 pieces. During a break in the recording on the breezy lawn outside the church, Smith said that the circumstances of his Vespers have been extraordinary from start to finish.
A lot of times you beat your head against the wall because you've got an idea for a piece that you want to write and you talk to other people and, you know, you struggle with it. But this thing, absolutely, all the pieces just fell together. And it's something that I'd wanted to write for a while. A few years ago, I heard a performance of the Monteverdi Vespers, the 1610 Vespers. But when this conversation came together that Piffero and I were having, and this idea came up, it just exploded into this project that went beyond anything I could control.
Normally, Piffero doesn't play music that's less than 400 years old. Yet, the idea of playing new music isn't really that alien, considering that very old music involves a lot of reinvention. At least in this case, there would be a central authority, the composer, to tell them when they were on the right track. Bringing in conductor Donald Nally and his all-professional virtuoso choir, The Crossing, meant that Smith was dealing with musicians who could cope with most anything. Smith responded by writing music with 16-part harmony, heard here in the January concert premiere of the Vespers. Modern composers love writing this kind of harmonic density, but very few of them have the chance to sustain a 70-minute span of music without an intermission, and since this isn't an opera, without a plot. Conductor Nally discovered this challenge was well in hand.
That variety and the way in which he keeps us constantly, you know, you'll hear voices for a while, and then you hear it with a harp, and then you might hear it, and then suddenly you've got the Shams coming in. And, you know. So I think that that helps to sustain the evening very easily. I don't have to work hard to make a drama out of it. You do go on a journey quite naturally through what he wrote.
Even those with faith in Kyle Smith didn't expect this music. Not even Piffero's Joan Kimball.
We took a chance to be sure, and we really didn't know until we started rehearsing what it was going to sound like. And when we first started, our jaws just dropped. Oh, this is great. This is really, really good stuff. I'm very excited.
Hardly a paragon of artistic temperament, Kyle Smith lives in Fox Chase with his wife of many years and their three daughters. Professionally, he's the longtime curator of the Fleischer Collection of Orchestral Music at the Free Library of Philadelphia. The psalms and hymns that are a natural part of any Vesper service are ones that he's known as a churchgoer for most of his adult life. His starting point with this piece, however, was visual.
What I had in my mind as a vision was that everyone was going to be sitting in this big church at night, in this big open space, and that this whatever music I was going to write was going to be the first thing that they were going to be hearing. It took me weeks to get these first four bars written, and they're only like four notes in the whole thing. But it took me that long to get them in the right order. And when that happened, the entire piece clicked for me. And then I knew I could write this thing.
Much of the piece came so quickly that when Piffero requested an extra instrumental movement to give the singers a rest, and did so less than a week before the premiere, he wrote it no problem. Many composers consider themselves to be, if not exactly religious, then spiritual. Even when writing something as wild as The Rite of Spring, Igor Stravinsky claimed he was only the conduit of music that came from elsewhere. Kyle Smith is quietly but deeply religious. He recalls experiences he had as a child when he felt the definite presence of God. Obviously, such spirituality is an advantage when writing a Vesper service. Nonetheless, British composer John Ruder has made a career out of composing sacred music and said years back that he didn't necessarily share the religious convictions of his audience. In contrast, when Kyle Smith reads some of the psalms he set to music, he admits that his eyes well up.
There could be composers who don't believe any of this and set it to music and it sounds fine and it sounds pretty. I don't know what the answer is to that. But saying that, there's got to be a way that it strikes you and that it makes sense to you and that it is really important to you. And if it's not, you shouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole because you're wasting your time. You should be doing other things that are important to you.
The difference that I hear is between the external religious experience, the pomp, the pageantry, and the interior experience, which doesn't necessarily deliver answers to age-old questions of existence, but expresses the need for them. And that's more likely to touch all manner of Christians, Jews, Muslims, and maybe even atheists.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Kyle Smith's Vespers by Piffero and The Crossing, conducted by Donald Nally, will be released by MMC Records. In the 1500s, the land that now makes up eastern Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, and southern New York was home to the Lenape Indians. But the Europeans arrived, and over the course of the next several centuries, most of this largely agrarian people were pushed westward, with large numbers eventually settling in Oklahoma. However, not everybody left the east, and in the late 20th century, a group of local educators tapped into this cultural community and recreated a 16th century village in Bucks County. WRTI's Susan Lewis recently visited the Lenape village at Churchill Nature Center in advance of this weekend's Lenape Powwow.
When you hear that drum It sounds, you know, it's like a heartbeat.
Barton Randall Cartwright, or Standing Elk, is a carpenter in Pennsylvania's Bucks County. He's also a Lenape Indian, or should we say Native American.
And nowadays, anybody can be a Native American that's born in America. If you say American Indian, that means you were here before the white man came. This guy, his name was Lord Thomas De La Warr. That was back in the early 1600s. He saw a bunch of Indians along the river. He called us the Delaware Indians, so we took that name.
Tall and slim, with dark eyes and a square jaw, deep voice and long straight black hair and a braid down his back, Bart looks as if he was sent from Central Casting. Indeed, he has played an American Indian in several movies. His mother was a full-blooded Lenape. Dancing since he was 14, Bart is the head male dancer in the 6th annual Lenape Village Powwow.
And it just feels real good to express myself. It gives a good feeling of being free and the back when it way was.
A glimpse of the way it was before the arrival of the European settlers can be had in the woods at Churchville Nature Center in Bucks County. A path cut through a shady forest of tall trees and low-lying plants leads to a clearing.
All of the things that they used for food and medicine is right there on the trail.
Marge Custer, no relation to you-know-who, is the director of the Nature Center's Lenape Village.
You can find enough food in the village here to make a salad. You could find animals for food, and the reservoir is over there with fish. So there's enough of everything right around here, just like a regular village would have been.
The village was built in 1991, thanks to the efforts of people like Custer, who wanted to fill an educational void.
The school districts here in Bucks County did not have any information on the Lenape Indians that lived in this area. When they studied American Indians, they studied the Plains Indians out in the Midwest.
In consultation with an archaeologist and full-blooded Lenape from Oklahoma, they built a replica of a self-sustaining village, which would have been home to an extended family of Lenape.
Over here is the garden where they planted the three sisters' corn, beans, and squash. They planted them in a mile.
Custer walks us through the village, with its places for cooking, pottery making, fire building, practical life stations that show how the Lenape made the most of their surroundings, wasting nothing. Bark from a plant known as dog bane was made into hemp. Trees cut down for the clearing became canoes. The skins of animals hunted for food became rawhide for drumheads and softer fabric for easy care garments.
To make it soft so they could make clothing, they would have to rub the brains into it. Every animal's brain has enough chemicals in it to tan its hide. It doesn't matter if it's a small squirrel or a deer or a bear or whatever it is. Whenever skin is brain tanned, you can wash that skin.
The village includes a storage pit for the dried meat, a medicine hut, and two wigwams made from saplings covered with bark. Over by the pond sits the sweat lodge, also made from saplings covered with skins. It's a kind of spiritual sauna with steam created by pouring water over hot rocks from the fire. Sweat lodges are still popular, used sometimes for naming ceremonies, as when Bart became Standing Elk at the age of 19.
When we say we're all related, we mean we're all related like the trees all have the spirits of their own.
Respecting nature, from plants to animals to other human beings, is central to the culture. Celebrating that culture with friends is what a powwow is all about.
The powwow came from the word powwow. That was like the abbreviation for a social gathering.
The women would work on shawls or regalia. The men would catch up on what was going on and work on drums and canoes and different things in that era.
Bart's wife, Kathy Cartwright, is the coordinator of this weekend's powwow.
Now they come together, they work on clothing and drumheads and sing songs, and the children run and get educated.
Kathy says many tribes come to the powwow.
Lenape's from New Jersey. Now I'm working on the Canadian group to bring them together because I want to bring all the different Delawares together from all the different states and countries.
Colorful dress or regalia, authentic foods, crafts, and games. And at the heart of the powwow, to the beat of the drum, is the dance. Traditional, fancy, for men or women.
Every time you stamp your feet, you're trying to stay with that beat of the drum.
Churchville Nature Center's Lenape Village is now under contract with all the schools in Bucks County. and hosts visits from, among others, 14,000 children a year. More than a museum, even an interactive one, it connects Native Americans like Lenape Bart Standing Elk with one another, with those of Native American descent like his wife Kathy, and with the rest of us. In representing the past, it connects with the present and helps give this part of American culture a voice for the future.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Churchill Nature Center's Lenape Village is transported to Cork Creek Park in Langhorne for this weekend's 6th annual Lenape Powwow. The powwow runs today until 8 p.m. and tomorrow from 10 till 6. There's much talk these days about improving the quality of arts education for children. Over the past 3 decades, various factors have contributed to a deterioration in the quality and quantity of what youngsters learn. Tighter budgets, a scarcity of qualified teachers, and pressure to spend more time on the so-called core subjects, reading, writing, and math. The No Child Left Behind Act has placed further pressure on schools to demonstrate progress in these areas through better test scores. It wasn't always so. In the 1970s, arts and music were an integral part of the Philadelphia public school system. There were art teachers in every school, and almost all middle and high schools had a band or orchestra. Today, arts and music are low on a list of priorities for a school district plagued with financial problems, high truancy rates, and student violence. Yet city officials say there is hope. The district currently spends more on arts education than many larger cities, like Los Angeles, and the School Reform Commission's budget for next year proposes an increase of more than $15 million for arts and music, and all this in a state that is among the worst in the nation for per capita spending on public education. To discuss these issues, we invited 3 people who are now grappling with the challenge of improving arts education for Philadelphia public school students. Pearl Schaefer is Executive Director of the Philadelphia Arts and Education Partnership, a local organization that encourages, promotes, and facilitates arts education programs. Gretchen Everson, the Picasso Project Coordinator for Public Citizens for Children and Youth, a regional children's advocacy group, and the publisher of the recent study, Portrait of Arts and Education in Our Public Schools. And Dennis Creedon, the Administrator of Creative and Performing Arts for the School District of Philadelphia. He oversees over 400 arts and music teachers in 267 schools, serving 167,000 children.
Children are Picasso at the age of 5, and they have advanced skills in the arts. It's just a question as to whether or not we understand what the skills are doing for the development of the brain, as well as then the social context of how it helps children make meaning and make relationships. But more importantly, I think the arts also feed us on a social level and a cognitive level in the sense of our well-being as social animals. And it's a communicative method that we all use and gravitate towards. The other thing that's important about the arts is it teaches not only creative problem solving, but it has been shown in music education to build the cortex of the brain. So it's important for us to look at not just the arts for the sake of research and development potentials in the future or the creative problem solving we need for the 21st century economy, but also what it does for us as human beings, as social animals.
Therefore, and I'm looking at you, Pearl Schaefer, why aren't we throwing vast quantities of money at all forms of arts education? Why isn't the federal government on board fully with the idea that this is equally as important as language skills, as reading and writing, as the sciences?
Well, I think traditionally we have looked at the arts as peripheral to core curricula. We've had a lot of very interesting anecdotal information, but now I think we're at the cusp of really making a push for the arts, moving into and claiming their rightful place as a core curricular subject area.
Gretchen Everson, if we look back at the 70s, and people who remember that time will remember Philadelphia as being a bastion of great arts education. Every high school had a marching band. We had arts teachers. We had music teachers. Your organization has recently produced a report telling us what the current state of the city is. Can you give us a brief overview of, well, how bad or maybe even how good is it?
From what we learned, both from the school district and from Pennsylvania Alliance for Arts Education, is that about half of Philadelphia's district students don't have access to arts education. And that is a crisis. When we're looking back at the 70s, the 60s, the 50s, when people who went to West Philly High actually had gigs at night, went to 52nd Street, played, were able to serve their community musically, were able to also live out their potential in the schools.
Pearl, some people would say that arts education, and particularly the people that you're in partnership with, have got an ulterior motive, that they're trying to create audiences of the future.
Yes, we need audiences. And if we give students an opportunity to learn in and through the arts, then they will feel comfortable buying tickets to go to the orchestra. They will feel as comfortable going to a dance performance as they do to a sporting event.
Dennis Creedon, I can see that you want to get in on this point.
The arts give us a whole synergy of not only emotional conscious connectiveness, but also a sense of resilience and self-belief, a hope. The arts birth hope in the human consciousness. When we create art, we ponder the potential of what we can become and what our dreams are going to hold. When we have the arts, we build our own inventive capacity to problem solve and to see things in an interrelated way. Everyone comes out of a culture. Everyone comes out of a collective community that celebrates its identity and its wealth of culture. We need to make sure that every child has that wealth, because that social capital, as it's called, enables us not only to climb the ladder of life, it also enables us to climb the ladder of hope. We can achieve and become whatever we allow our children to dream, but we have to feed the dream, and we feed the dreams of children through the arts.
Dennis Creedon, the Administrator of Creative and Performing Arts for the School District of Philadelphia. We also heard from Gretchen Everson of Public Citizens for Children and Youth, and Pearl Schaefer, the Executive Director of the Philadelphia Arts and Education Partnership. In their original context, the plays of William Shakespeare were accessible to an array of people. It wasn't merely entertainment for aristocrats and the well-to-do. The working class, the general public, who could afford to pay a penny, were also able to see the plays in open-air structures like the Globe. They were called groundlings, as they stood on the ground in front of the stage, with no roof over their heads. Around the world today, the tradition of performing Shakespearean works in an outdoor venue with easy accessibility continues. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, West Philadelphia's Clark Park is one such stage.
It was in a downpour of rain at a shopping mall 4 years ago that, ironically, Marla Burkholder and Maria Muller conceived the idea of presenting Shakespeare in Philadelphia's outdoors. Following in the footsteps of perennial events like New York City's Shakespeare in the Park, Burkholder and Muller decided to offer free Shakespeare plays in Clark Park, a 9-acre site that Muller says few parks in Philadelphia, other than the sprawling Fairmount Park, can match.
There are parks, but they're not parks where you could feel like you were really getting away from the city. The area around Clark Park is just a real treasure, I think, in Philadelphia. It's an area where there are people who are very active in their communities, from all different sorts of communities, and people really utilize the park. And it's a real gathering spot and a crossroads for people to come and meet. And so it just seemed like the natural place.
With an old pond that was drained years ago, now called the Bowl, Clark Park was established in 1895 on land donated by banker Clarence Howard Clark. The Bowl, which borders the intersection of 45th Street and Chester Avenue, is the stage area for Shakespeare in Clark Park. And the time period of its establishment also provides the Victorian setting for this year's Shakespeare in Clark Park show, As You Like It. The romantic comedy centers on Rosalind, who was banished from the royal court by her uncle. Disguising herself as a boy, she adventurously flees to the Forest of Arden, as do other players of the story. Director Maria Muller says that not unlike residents of a city who seek to escape the restrictions and bustle of urban life in parks, the Forest of Arden serves as a refuge for the characters of As You Like It.
It's this in-between space, this liminal space, where everybody runs off to the forest, and it's a little frightening, it's a little strange, but really it's a place where people lose their inhibitions, lose the constraints of being in the civilized world, and can explore their identities, explore their love, and work on all those things in sort of the safety net of the forest.
With over 300 trees and acres of green grass, it's not a stretch to imagine Clark Park as the Forest of Arden. But performing in a heavily used public space without a conventional stage requires mobility and especially creative solutions.
You have a very portable set because we have to put it up and take it down every single night and then store it in a shed. We also have to set up and strike our lighting equipment and work within the parameters of starting out in natural light and moving into darkness. And of course, there's always the uncertainty of doing theater outside.
This includes the weather, insects, wayward children, and the occasional stray animal.
Our first year when we did Twelfth Night, we had a dog run onto the stage during the first scene and just really not want to leave, you know, and was just sniffing at the actors.
Shakespeare's script calls for songs to be sung at certain points in the story. What exactly he had in mind for these musical moments is anyone's guess, so creators of any As You Like It production are left to their own devices. Andrew Nelson composed music for the songs of Clark Park's rendition.
The piece is set in the 1890s, so we use that as a starting point for the music, and in listening to 1890s music, it's just these kind of happy-go-lucky songs, you know, sort of love songs. It reminds me sort of the quote-unquote innocence of the 50s.
Nelson says writing music in a certain style is one thing, but creating an a cappella song with Shakespearean lyrics is quite another matter.
The text does certain things to the music that I hadn't been expecting because of the phrasing of the text and the way it's arranged. It doesn't work like other lyrics that I've set music to.
Here shall he see no enemy but winter and rough weather, but winter and rough weather.
Along with the hurdles of writing music for a Shakespeare play, the open expanse of Clark Park makes it difficult to naturally hear the singing and dialogue, and so actors are mic'd for Shakespeare in Clark Park. Still, overall, the production elements of the annual event are kept at a basic level. This is reflected in the music, set, and lighting. They're not overpowering. Yet restrained as the design components might be, the acting in Clark Park can't afford to be underplayed. The park lacks the benefit of a compact seating arrangement and the acoustics of an indoor auditorium to continually direct audience focus to the stage. Actor Justin Jane, who has been part of all the Shakespeare in Clark Park productions, explains performers need to ensure that they remain the center of attention.
The style for this has to be truthful, but you have to do it in a bigger, bigger way. Sometimes you'll have to have a scene where you're yards away from your scene partner, and it's a really intimate moment.
The weaving together of the modest but hopefully compelling show elements, says Maria Muller, is designed to make the show accessible for audiences of all ages and backgrounds. She says even with the old English vernacular, a Shakespeare piece can do this.
We see that in the park when we have, you know, little kids stop riding their bicycles and come over and sit down and watch dress rehearsals, then, you know, you're getting it, people.
Now in its third year, Shakespeare in Clark Park is doing well, generating a lot of community support. Last year, 2,500 people came out over the course of 5 days. The Bard writes in As You Like It that all the world's a stage. As the popularity of the Clark Park stage grows in the world of West Philadelphia, it's in keeping with Shakespeare's tradition of presenting theater to a diverse mix of people under the open sky.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Shakespeare in Clark Park opens on Wednesday and runs through August 3rd. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at www.wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.